Hi, I'm Ivan Semenek. Welcome to The Universe in Mind. Everyone knows what a wave is, right? It's not really a thing so much as it's a disturbance moving through something, through a medium like water or air, the way sound waves move through air. But now consider that space itself could be a kind of medium. At least that's what Einstein thought. And if he was right, that means that space itself can be disturbed by waves. Little ripples in the medium of space called gravity waves. You can't see gravity waves, but these days scientists are doing their best to discover them. They're attempting this with the help of extremely large and sensitive detectors that can measure the way space gets stretched and squeezed when a gravity wave rolls by. It's a totally different way of perceiving the universe, more like hearing rather than seeing. And that's a big change, because up till now, studying the universe has been a bit like watching a silent movie. Detecting gravity waves would be like adding the soundtrack. So far, that hasn't happened, but this year, the world's biggest gravity wave experiment, known as LIGO, is moving into a more enhanced phase. That means it's going to have improved sensitivity, and by 2013, it will become advanced LIGO, which will be 10 times more sensitive than it is today. So the first gravity wave detection is getting closer. It may be very close. To find out what that means, I'm joined by Neil Cornish. He's an associate professor of astrophysics at Montana State University in Bozeman, and he specializes in gravitational wave astronomy. Neil Cornish, welcome to The Universe in Mind.
Thank you.
I'd like to start with this idea that detecting gravity waves would be like adding a soundtrack to our movie of the universe. What does that really mean?
It's an analogy that's actually surprisingly close. Of course, there's no sound in space, there's no air molecules, but these gravity waves, the idea is that when you have violent events in the universe, large concentrations of mass moving around, that it actually stirs up waves in the fabric of space-time itself. So there's a fluctuations in the curvature of space-time, and so you'll have, say, two black holes crashing together, and they'll throw off ripples into the fabric of space-time, which then move out like ripples in a pond, and the vibrations are in space itself. We can take those and then convert them to sounds and listen to the sounds of black holes colliding.
Well, I'd love to hear an example of one of those sound analogs. I know no gravity waves have been detected yet, but what might they sound like?
Right, so we're able to, you know, use Einstein's equations and our understanding of what these sounds should sound like. And basically what's happening is you've got, say, a system with two black holes. They're orbiting around one another. In doing so, they're emitting these gravitational waves, but the gravitational waves carry energy, and they also carry away the spin or angular momentum of the system. So as they emit the waves, they spiral in towards each other. Their orbits become tighter and tighter, so they start moving faster and faster, and they also get into a regime where they're moving faster, and it's a much stronger gravitational field, so the gravitational waves coming out get louder. So basically, you have a sound, the characteristic sound is one that is increasing in pitch, so going up in frequency, increasing in pitch, and also increasing in amplitude or loudness.
Okay, we've got that sound queued up, so let's listen to it right now. Okay, so these are black holes converging?
Yes, those were two non-spinning black holes coming together. And then if you listen to this other sound here, what we're going to hear, this is two spinning black holes. So each one is spinning around, and then they're orbiting one another. And that actually leads to the plane of the orbit moving about, tilting with respect to your antenna that you're using to detect them. And so that will modulate the signal. So you'll hear its amplitude going up and down. You'll still hear the characteristic sort of sweep up in pitch and amplitude, but it's going to do it in sort of a pulsating fashion now, because it's sometimes softer, sometimes louder.
Okay, let's have a listen to two rotating black holes in the act of colliding with each other. Okay, well, that was certainly different from the first example. And I guess what strikes me about these examples you've given us is that there really is quite a lot of information you can extract, potentially, from gravitational waves, even though these systems are completely invisible to the eye or to any sort of optical or other kind of detection.
That's right. They're really speaking to us. They are actually telling a very complex story. The human ear isn't able to discern all of the features that were actually in those waves that we just heard played. In fact, by measuring a system like that with, say, one of these future space detectors, we're actually able to measure the masses of the black holes to incredible precision, much less than 1% precision. So it's actually a very high precision form of measurement that can be done using these sounds.
Now, light waves have a spectrum that human eyes can perceive, from red to violet, and even more wavelengths that we can't see. Is there an equivalent spectrum for gravity waves?
Yes, there's a spectrum of gravitational waves. In terms of where we expect to find signals, it spans everything from the Hubble frequency, which is 1 over the age of the universe, down at 10 to the minus 16 hertz, some ridiculously tiny frequency, all the way up to megahertz range, which might be possible signatures from the processes when the early expansion of the universe slowed down. The end of the inflationary period has been predicted to produce, in some scenarios, quite high-frequency gravitational waves. And in between, you've got a whole spectrum of astrophysical sources, such as black holes of various sizes colliding, supernova explosions, more esoteric possibilities, like sort of whip-crack sounds from cosmic strings, with thin filaments of energy that some theories of the early universe predict might be out there. So there's a whole potential orchestra out there that we're waiting to hear.
Well, and speaking of waiting, the LIGO detectors have been running for a while now. Is it that they're not yet sensitive enough to pick up the waves that should be passing through?
That's right. Even when they were first designed, it wasn't expected that they would be guaranteed to make a detection. There were predictions of what kind of strength of signals we might expect to find, and the first generation of detectors were just a little bit below the level where we could be confident that we'd definitely make a detection. So I think the hope was we'd get lucky, that there'd be a rare event would happen, or there'd be something we hadn't thought of that would be louder than anything we'd predicted. So we're still looking for that. But the plan was to use the first generation as a stepping stone to understand the technology and use it as a way to get towards these advanced detectors. And they've been very successful in that. They've reached already absolutely phenomenal sensitivities. They track the distance between these mirrors, which are separated by 4 kilometers in a vacuum tube. They track the distance between those mirrors to the accuracy of 1/1000th the width of a proton. So it's a phenomenally sensitive measuring device, and it's going to get better still. So
now we're moving into enhanced LIGO. How much better will it be?
So in terms of the distance tracking of these mirrors, it will be an improvement of somewhere a factor of 2 or 3 in accuracy, which actually translates then into the volume of the universe that allows you to explore. It goes as the cube of that factor. So it's somewhere between 8 and almost 30, perhaps, increase in the volume of the universe that you're able to explore with the enhanced range of detectors. So you're just seeing more galaxies, more stars, so you're chances of seeing something just go up by that factor. So, you know, it's 30 times or 10 times more likely to see something any given day than the previous generation.
And to get a sense of how much universe we're talking about, what is the range of the detectors, and so how much larger will it be?
So the range for detecting something like 2 neutron stars merging is about 15 megaparsecs, which are those crazy units we like to use. You've got to multiply that by 3 to get to light years. So it's, you know, of order 50 million light years, which sounds like a long way, and you certainly want to try and walk it. But in astronomical terms, that's still nearby. Mm-hmm. That's the sort of known as the local group of galaxies is basically what that's probing. And so the next range of so for the advanced detectors, which a factor of 10 or so better than the initial detectors, that'll take you out into the hundreds of megaparsecs regime, and for black hole systems even further yet out into gigaparsecs. And once you start talking gigaparsecs, you're really talking cosmology type scales. That's really getting back to when the universe was significantly younger than it is today.
And so instead of looking at a handful of galaxies, you're looking at thousands and thousands of galaxies, and whatever's going on in those galaxies, you'll be able to pick them up.
Right.
That's great. So now, what's the scientific payoff of something like this? You know, we've talked about colliding black holes and neutron stars, but in terms of the big picture, what will it really do for us to be able to open up this new way of perceiving the universe?
Well, there's a whole set of science goals and ideas of what we will learn, and some of those include being able to test for the first time whether Einstein's theory of gravity is really correct when you apply it to strong field systems where you're getting something towards a black hole. We've really got no measurements that really get in and probe close to a black hole. We have no measurements yet of dynamical gravity, so we don't have any, we don't know if gravity travels at the speed of light. That's Einstein's prediction. Are black holes really black holes? Do they have event horizons? All of those things can be answered by gravitational wave astronomy. So it, on the one hand, provides very stringent tests of Einstein's theory of gravity, but it's also a astronomical probe. Just as the Hubble Space Telescope isn't up there to study photons, it's there to study the galaxies that emitted those photons. Right. But in some ways, we're also a little bit like a sighted person who's deaf trying to figure out what it would be like to hear things. And I think ultimately we're going to discover that we won't really know what we're going to learn and find out until we can start hearing the universe.
So, Neil, now that technology is moving forward, how long do you think before the first gravity waves are detected?
I am very confident we'll have the first detection before 2015. And I would even be as bold as to say that Enhanced LIGO might have something by 2011.
Well, bold is a great note on which to end a conversation. Thanks for that prediction. I hope you're right, Neil Cornish, in which case I'm sure we'll be speaking again. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Neil Cornish is eagerly awaiting the first detection of gravity waves from his home base at Montana State University in Bozeman. Up next, when strangers meet, they can always talk about the weather. And now, when astronomers meet, they can talk about weather on brown dwarfs. Now, it may not be thunder and lightning, but recently a team of astronomers has come up with what could be the best evidence yet that brown dwarfs have weather. Just to fill in the background a bit, a brown dwarf is a strange kind of object that's halfway between a star and a planet. It's too small to fuse hydrogen into helium, which is what makes stars like the Sun shine. But brown dwarfs are tens of times more massive than Jupiter, the largest planet in our solar system, and they can be found on their own in space, just the way stars are. They don't have to be orbiting a larger object. Brown dwarfs are tiny and faint and rare, which makes them hard to study. But recently, Etienne Artigot of the Gemini South Observatory in Chile and his colleagues found a brown dwarf that was changing in brightness with a regular cycle about every 2.5 hours. But that's not all. Let's let Etienne Artigot tell the rest of the story.
The structure of that modulation, so it's really a modulation of flux of about 5 to 7%, you see it evolving from night to night, so it's a sign that there's something happening on the surface of the object, something bright and dark moving, and you see a modulation due to the rotation of it. And not only that, that this thing is evolving with time.
So to get the signal that Artigo is seeing, the brown dwarf has to be spinning, and it also has to have light and dark patches. And those patches have to be moving around, a little bit like cloud formations. At least that's the idea. To find out more, I spoke with Jacqueline Radigan. She's a graduate student in the Department of Astronomy and Astrophysics right here at the University of Toronto, and she loves brown dwarfs. Jacqueline Radigan, welcome to the Universe in Mind.
Thank you.
I'd like to start by asking you why there seems to be so much interest in the astronomical community today in brown dwarfs. What is it about these objects that has everyone so fired up?
Well, I think brown dwarfs are great because they fall right in between the regime of stars and planets. So they're a little bit less massive than stars. By definition, they're objects that are never massive enough to burn hydrogen stably, and they spend their lives simply cooling. And they're slightly more massive than the most massive giant extrasolar planets. So by studying these objects, we kind of have a foot in both worlds, and we can learn something about star formation as well as planet formation. And at this point, we're not able to really directly image very many extrasolar planets, but we can directly image a lot of brown dwarfs, and by looking at these brown dwarfs with cool atmospheres, we have kind of our first glimpse at what very cool exoplanet atmospheres may eventually look like.
Well, that's great, and I want to ask you about that as well, because as we've just heard, there's this evidence for a brown dwarf, maybe the best evidence so far, of a brown dwarf having complex weather patterns. So is that an exciting development?
I think it's incredibly exciting because there has been the expectation that brown dwarfs would have weather for a long time. Brown dwarfs, as they cool, reach temperatures below around 2000 Kelvin, and this happens to be the point at which dust grains can condense from their atmospheres. So brown dwarfs are expected to have all of these solid dust grain particles that form dust clouds.
So this is expected, that there should be something going on, that these clouds should be forming in a brown dwarf.
Yeah, it's definitely expected that dust particles and clouds will form. Whether these clouds are very homogeneous and their atmospheres look more like stars, or whether the clouds are broken up, that's an interesting question. And with this first detection of weather patterns, it really looks like these brown dwarf atmospheres may be much more similar to, say, planetary atmospheres or Jupiter-like atmospheres with storms and variations.
Well, that's a very vivid picture. I'm trying to imagine what I should be picturing, and especially when you say dust, that's a little bit confusing because I can picture Jupiter, and so that's a planet in my mind, what a giant planet looks like. I can also picture the sun, with its bright, shining surface, but neither of those makes me think of dust. So what is this dust that's forming in brown dwarfs, and what is it made of, and why in particular is it forming in brown dwarfs?
Well, for instance, let's start with Jupiter. The clouds you see on Jupiter are mostly ammonia ice. Mm-hmm. On a brown dwarf, you have refractory elements, so elements with the highest boiling points that start to condense out first. So you've got things like magnesium and silicon and iron, and you get dust grains of, say, phosphorite and enstatite, and these type of particles that are forming your dust grains.
So these are little minerals, basically.
Exactly.
Forming in the atmosphere of these sort of non-star-like objects.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how much dust, how thick is the dust? Is that basically what we're talking about when we talk about weather?
Yeah, so when you're talking about weather, you're actually talking about inhomogeneities developing in these, expansive dust clouds. So, for instance, maybe holes and patches developing. We really don't know for sure. I mean, you could imagine that maybe you have bands and types of winds, as you would see on Jupiter. In some brown dwarfs, at least there's evidence that these features are evolving fairly rapidly before the brown dwarf has a chance to rotate completely. So what's really exciting about this new discovery is that the features seem very stable. So it looks like you have, say, a hole in your clouds, and that feature is staying there for a whole rotation period of the brown dwarf, such that you can see the light of the brown dwarf increasing and then dimming again as the object rotates.
So the brown dwarf is turning around, and there are these features which are in the atmosphere which have a longer time scale than the rotation period, and so we're sort of seeing them over and over again. But I guess they're also changing over time.
Exactly. So in the order of a few rotation periods, maybe the pattern has changed a little. But mm-hmm. by looking at the amount of brightening that you get and basically how sharp the increase in brightening and the decrease in brightening is, you can kind of paint yourself a picture of what it may look like. And we're looking at a spot or a few spots or holes. When I say spots, I mean holes in this cloud coverage that cover between, 10 and 20% of the visible disk of your brown dwarf surface.
Okay, so that's interesting. You're almost giving us a picture of what it would be like to see one up close. So let's do that. Let's take that imaginary trip. Suppose we could fly up to a brown dwarf up close. Now, I guess the one big difference between that and Jupiter in our solar system, one additional difference is that Jupiter is illuminated by the sun. So when we see Jupiter, we're actually seeing it lit from the outside. If a brown dwarf were off on its own in space, even if it has these stripes or these other features, how would that appear to the eye?
Well, brown dwarfs are emitting most of their flux in the infrared, so we'd have to put on our infrared goggles.
Okay, we'll put on the infrared goggles.
Exactly. And what I imagine you'd see is these dark, very red objects and with kind of patchy coverage where you'd have these bright holes and patches where your dust has kind of cleared. And as this brown, as you would watch this brown dwarf rotate, you would probably see different patches of cloud coverage come in and out of view that were slightly hotter.
Now, I'm wondering what would be driving all of that. I guess, in science, there's this tendency to go for the simplest case. And if these mineral grains can form in the atmosphere of a brown dwarf, why wouldn't they just be everywhere in a kind of fog? Why would we expect, these spots or these bare patches? And obviously we seem to be getting that because these new observations suggest there are variations. So why do you think that's happening?
It's a really good question, and a lot of people are trying to answer that with modeling right now. The only kind of answer that I have is that atmospheres are very dynamic places where you've got turbulence and you've got convection and you've got a lot of things that could be disrupting these cloud coverages.
And is this something that would change over time? I don't know, does a brown dwarf change over time?
Well, brown dwarfs start off by cooling. So the standard picture is that when dust starts to form, it forms high up in the radiative zone of the atmosphere, so not where convection is necessarily happening, and it's relatively stable. And as the brown dwarf cools, and dust starts to settle, that you may have kind of more interplay with more dynamic zones of lower down in the atmosphere.
Right. So it may start off looking kind of dull, but, at least from a distance.
Kind of dull and dim, exactly.
Right. But then as time goes on, it ironically, as it's cooling, it may brighten up or break up or...
Well, you may start to have disruption in your cloud mm-hmm. decks. Mm-hmm. And as the disruption happens and the clouds break up, you suddenly have all of this... this light from deeper and warmer layers of your brown dwarf that can escape.
You were also saying that one thing that makes brown dwarfs so interesting is that there's the possibility of getting images of these things and comparing and imagining, I guess, what exoplanets might be like around other stars, and it's hard to image exoplanets. So I know at this point we're just talking about variations in brightness, but is this object something that could be imaged in the future?
So when I say image, I mean the ability to get kind of... a light curve, like we already have, and to obtain spectra. Brown dwarfs are very, very small in terms of their radius, so it's hard to get a picture. It's hard to be able to use current instrumentation to resolve their surface. So that's not possible at this point.
Okay, so it's not going to be a snapshot showing clouds.
No, it's not
going to
be a picture like we see of Jupiter.
Right, so then what do you get by combining the brightness differences with the spectra? When you say that's an image, what kind of picture does that give you?
Well, what's the most interesting thing to do is really combine them by getting time-resolved spectra. And by getting time-resolved spectra, you can actually see how different features in the brown dwarf's atmosphere may be changing with time. So you can look at a feature that may be related to the inner hotter region of the brown dwarf, the region that we think we're seeing in the breaks through the clouds. And we can see how this feature may change and see if it corresponds with the changes in brightness as it should. And we can get an idea of the actual, how the composition over the surface of the brown dwarf may be changing as the brown dwarf rotates.
So, Jacqueline, this is an area where there are a lot of younger researchers kind of near the beginning of their careers moving into the area studying brown dwarfs. You're in that category. What is it that you find so interesting about this particular kind of object? What motivates you?
What I find really interesting about studying low mass, substellar objects, brown dwarfs, exoplanets, is that you're getting closer to a type of science that describes where you and I came from. you know, we are kind of the leftovers of what happens during star formation, you know, where the coolest objects are formed, and just understanding, you know, these processes of star and planet formation. So we're just really starting to get an idea of what happens on the coolest and smallest scales of star formation.
I like that, the coolest and the smallest. So, well, Jacqueline, thank you very much for bringing the coolest and smallest to the universe in mind. We're looking forward to hearing more. Thanks very much.
Okay, thank you very much.
That's it for this episode of The Universe in Mind. You can subscribe to our show on iTunes. The Universe in Mind is sponsored by the Dunlap Institute for Astronomy and Astrophysics and produced here at the University of Toronto. Kathy Parrott is our online producer. Our cover art is by Bettina Forget. I'm Ivan Semenik. Join us again soon for more excursions into the realm of astronomical ideas. And in the meantime, don't forget to keep the universe in mind. Thanks.